Hi everyone, and welcome to the Loopcast. So today we are going to have a show which I thought would be a really interesting tie-in with a lot of the shows we've done in the past, where we're either looking at the issues in Syria and Iraq, or jihadist movements and foreign fighters. And there was this great article that was recently posted on Jihadology, and it's called "The Clear Banners: Turkish Foreign Fighters and the Ogaden." Sorry about that. So I'm very happy to have the two authors on the show, and they are the North Caucus bloggers, and they're both analysts. One's an African analyst, O.S. Mahmoud, and they are based here in Washington, D.C. So thank you for coming on the show first.
No problem.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
So why don't we, just to start out, give me an idea of where you got the inspiration for this topic, since of course media right now are hearing about lots of foreign fighters going to Syria and the battles in Iraq and Syria. So where did the idea and the inspiration for this article on these Turkish fighters come from?
Well, in 2013 and early 2014, I had written two articles for Jihadology, one on Turkish foreign fighters in Syria and the other on Azerbaijani foreign fighters in Syria. But while I was researching the article on Turkish foreign fighters in Syria, I stumbled upon a great deal of historical information about Turks who had been involved in Iraq, Afghanistan, Bosnia, Chechnya, and there was one that stuck out, which I had never heard of before, which was the Ogaden. So I looked into it, and I found out it was this conflict in Ethiopia in the 90s, and luckily, I had a good friend who is an expert on the Horn of Africa, so I went to him. This was a really long article in the making, but we were able to get it together. So that was basically it.
So I will pass this on to your partner, and let's hear about your experience, since you are an African analyst. And as your partner just mentioned, he came to you for co-authorship.
Sure. I mean, I've always been interested in the Horn of Africa region, and particularly the dynamics of Somalia have really interested me over the past two decades, and sort of all the chaotic events there. And so following the Ogaden has been part of that as well. And we've heard about foreign fighters there a little bit in the early 90s, but there hasn't been a lot of information, a lot of detail. And then when my colleague here came to me with this story about these Turkish foreign fighters, I thought it was a really interesting element, because often when you were thinking about foreign fighters in the region, you were also thinking just either neighboring countries or other Arab nations. I hadn't really thought about Turkish involvement there, which is kind of also an interesting corollary given Turkish involvement in rebuilding Somalia today. So I thought it was a very interesting historical example to look into, and luckily he was able to uncover some pretty interesting data points.
That's very true, and we will, of course, post a link to the article for our listeners. They can look at the full piece of work and the data that's in it. It's very, very interesting. So let's look at this setting. So these fighters go to the region in 1996, which is an interesting time. So I was wondering if we could discuss the setting of 1996 that revs up to these young men. There are 14 Turkish young men that go to Ogaden. So why don't one of you let us know about the setting that this story takes place in?
Sure. So 1996 was an interesting time for aspiring jihadis, as two of the big jihadi conflicts of the 1990s were wrapping up. First, the conflict in Bosnia ended in December of 1995 at the signing of the Dayton Accords. A number of these fighters actually had experience, had gone to Bosnia right at the end of the war, and had found that when they arrived, the war was over, essentially over. And part of the Dayton Accords required there was 3,000 to 6,000 foreign fighters who had been involved in the conflict, but the Dayton Agreement required them to leave, and many of them did. Additionally, the conflict in Chechnya had also been wrapping up at this time, and in August of 1996, the Hasavyurt Agreement was signed, which essentially ended the war. And also, the Russians had become much better at stopping the flow of foreigners into the conflict by this time. So if you were interested in becoming involved, it'd be you'd have to look a little bit further afield at that time. So the Ogaden, Kashmir, some of these less known conflicts.
And I find it interesting because, as you mentioned, you have these two major battles, Bosnia, Chechnya, where you saw so many young individuals going to fight over there. And all of a sudden you have these young men, say in Turkey and probably elsewhere, that have these jihadi aspirations. And it comes to this point of where do we go to fulfill these aspirations? So it seems like the Ogaden really offered them that environment, that theater, I guess you could call it. I was wondering if we could look at this situation of the Ogaden. How did the region in Ethiopia basically become this theater for a jihad and a battle? What is the history behind it?
Sure. Well, the Ogaden's had a very contentious history marked by cycles of conflict, which continue to this day, really. It's a region that's predominantly inhabited by ethnic Somalis, but it became a part of the Ethiopian Empire between the late 19th century, early 20th century, as they were expanding out of their sort of more highland areas. But in the post-World War II period, as the British took over Italian possessions, they were in possession of the Ogaden and administering it, and they wound up handing it back to Ethiopia. Now, this was a big deal for a lot of Somali nationalists at the time who were arguing for this idea of a greater Somalia, as through the process of colonization, Somali-inhabited lands had been divided. You have Djibouti, you have the borders of Somalia, you have northern Kenya, and you have the Ogaden region. So handing that back to the Ethiopians was a real dent in sort of this greater Somali nationalist project. And inevitably, that led to movements. In the early 1970s, these started to heat up a little bit with support from the Somali government at the time. And that wound up culminating in a devastating Cold War battle in 1977-78, when the Somali National Army actually invaded the Ogaden, viewing it as a ripe time to acquire it by force. But the Ethiopians wound up prevailing thanks in large part to Soviet Union help and Cuban soldiers who were actually on the ground at the time. And so it was this really interesting Cold War proxy battle, but at the same time, it wound up ending Somalia's attempts to reacquire the region by force. If you fast forward then to the 1990s, our periods of interest, there's a lot of interesting dynamics going on in Somalia and Ethiopia at this time. In Ethiopia, the Derg regime led by Mengistu winds up falling, and a new government is ushered in under Meles Zenawi. And this government is really pushing for a more federal structure. And within the constitution they incorporate, there's actually this article, Article 39, which allows regions within Ethiopia referendum on self-determination. So this is music to the ears of many in the Ogaden. However, in practice, this didn't really play out that way, and it wasn't quite as federal as advertised. And so the ruling party at the time there, the Ogaden National Liberation Front, winds up leaving the political scene with a wing focused on armed resistance. And this ignites the most recent cycle of conflict again. We can talk about how then the Islamist actors sort of get involved within the early 90s. Because the ONLF was more of a secular Ogaden clan-based movement. But then within Somalia at this time, there's this movement Al-Ittihad Al-Islamiya, AIAI. And they had been growing in the late 80s, in the 70s and 80s, this sort of Salafist ideology starts seeping in a bit more in Somali culture, predominantly from a Gulf influence. And AIA is the predominant movement within Somalia at this time. By the early 90s, they wind up focusing on armed resistance and jihad. And again, in Somalia at this time in 1991, their central government collapsed too, and dictator Siad Barre flees. So it's sort of a chaotic situation. And AIA is involved in battles throughout Somalia at this time, but they develop a wing focused on the Ogaden in particular. And this kind of brings back this idea of this greater Somalia, this idea that we can reunite all Somali inhabited lands. At the same time, they infuse that with sort of an Islamist rhetoric. And the conflict in the Ogaden was very easy to portray in this sort of narrative as rising up against a Christian empire that is illegally occupying Islamic Somali land. And so they were based in Luke in the border, a town on the border at this time, but they also established camps in the Ogaden and waged a low-intensity battle there.
I'm looking at AIAI. Were they a big group, or was it a smaller group at the starting that grew bigger through the conflict? Or is this a well-funded group? What is their makeup?
Sure. So they were kind of, I'd say they were more of a sort of umbrella term, because there was multiple AIAI sort of movements going on in different parts of the country. You had one in the north in Bosaso, you had some in the south down in Kismayo, and then you had this wing focused on the Ogaden that was based in Luke on the border. So they were kind of spread out throughout Somalia at this time, but they also militarily wound up suffering a lot of defeats and moving and relocating throughout the region. And so the ones in the north and actually the south wound up kind of more or less disbanding, and this Ogaden wing was one of the few remaining.
And if people research Al-Ittihad Al-Islami, there are talks about there being a connection with Al-Qaeda, and I was wondering if we could look at that element and the validity of it, what sort of connection AIAI had with Al-Qaeda, if any. So I was wondering if either one of you could discuss that topic a bit.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's interesting to look at the Ogaden region in this context, because at this time, in the early 90s, Osama bin Laden's living in Sudan, and Ogaden kind of gets on his radar. And becomes really interested in sort of helping some of the movements there, to the point where he reportedly invested $3 million to bring foreign fighters and establish camps in the region. And again, remember in the early 1990s within Somalia, you have U.S. troops operating, you have United Nations peacekeepers, so it seems like a natural sort of region to get involved with for Al-Qaeda. So a lot of what we know is actually from the Harmony documents, which is a declassified database of Al-Qaeda memos. There's not a lot out there on Al-Qaeda movements or foreign fighters within the Ogaden at this time outside of that. But essentially, within those documents, there's some reports where Al-Qaeda dispatched a team to get in touch with AIAI members along the border region and in Ogaden, and they wound up establishing three training camps, one in Luke and one actually in the Ogaden, where they trained likely a few hundred fighters and also facilitated sort of an influx of foreign fighters at this time.
So I was wondering, looking at the research that you've done in this article, what types of sources did you use to find out about these individuals, which I'd also like to talk about further on in this talk, but what type of source material did you find your data from?
Sure. I was lucky that there are several websites, for example, shaheedlaramizin.com, which is Our Martyrs. It's a website that is dedicated to Turkish Islamists who have gone and fought abroad, as well as been killed in internal conflicts, mainly against Kurdish separatists. But these sites reproduce media reporting from contemporary media reporting including often they had the articles themselves, but mostly just the text. So those were the main source for the information about the Turkish fighters.
So going back to actually these young men that you highlight in this article, I would really like to talk about the fighters in particular. I know that you've highlighted 14 individuals, but you in the article have talked about certain individuals and their life before going to the Ogaden, their background, their family history. So why don't we just start off with the basic idea of what are the age ranges of these young men that travel to the Ogaden for jihad?
Sure. All of them were in their early to mid-20s. One guy might have been a little bit closer to 30. But actually, before we get there, I wanted to, before we get too far away talking about connections between AQ and AIAI, I wanted to talk about the potential that these fighters ended up kind of coalescing around one guy, who was Attila Sultan. Attila Sultan had gone to Bosnia, like many of these other fighters, but it's reported that while he was in Bosnia, he met other foreign fighters who were guys that informed him about the conflict in the Ogaden. And it's known at this time that in Bosnia, there was AQ recruiters for other conflicts talking to the Mujahideen who were there since the war was over. So my basic theory on this is that possibly AQ connected with him, and then he was kind of the catalyst for all these other guys. And they, because it said that he left Turkey with at least 10 other guys. So it's a strong possibility that he was the catalyst, all these other guys kind of coalesced around him, and they all kind of went together, or at least some of the other guys had connections to that initial group. But getting back to your previous point, so these guys, yeah, they're mainly just young men in their 20s. Most of them, from the available information, they came from, a lot of them lived in Istanbul, even though they had different hometowns, but they were college students. Many of them appeared to be relatively well off, quite similar to a lot of other foreign fighters from a lot of different other countries and a lot of other situations. Young men who felt that they, you know, had to do something, that they couldn't let these conflicts go on without them being involved.
So that's one of my questions, which looking at, of course, modern day Syria and the individuals that are going to Syria, what have you found in your research has been the general first draw for these young men? Is it, as you just alluded to, this idea of going to the Ogaden in this case to do good, to help? Are there other elements also that tend to be the first spark of this is a path I'm going down? What have you found with these individuals?
With these individuals, a lot of it seems to be that they're young guys, they're often religious, and a lot of it appears to be at least one of the friends becoming involved in it, and then a second friend or a brother or a cousin being the draw. Some of them seem to have more kind of ideological affinity with this sort of thing, while some of them appeared more to have got into it later in life or simply more for adventurism. At least, let's see. I mean, talking about, a lot of this information came out with interviews with their parents after they had died. And some of them had been working, and their parents had wanted them to get married or get better jobs. But they had claimed that, oh, you know, we have higher ideals. We have to do something. And they actually, one of them wrote a letter to his family from the Ogaden saying he felt guilty about having such a good life in Turkey while there was injustice and deprivation occurring all over the world. And at least some of them, their parents had been relatively supportive. The father of one of the fighters, Ismail Ozturk, who had gone to Bosnia and couldn't, the war was over, and then he had tried to go to Chechnya, but he actually got turned back, who then hooked up with Attila Sultan and ended up in the Agadan. But he was actually, I mean, he reported being relatively happy about the kind of the outcome, and that he had said, you know, when they were young, I had brought my sons, books from Libya, and I was hoping that they would internalize this stuff, and they had. So I feel like I was successful. And actually, Ismail Ozturk's twin brother, who had wanted to go to the Agadan, but then couldn't for some reason, ended up dying later in Kashmir, a year later.
That's really interesting, the family connection of the father of one of the individuals you're highlighting having jihadist aspirations, traveling to different regions for jihad. How much of that do you think, as you mentioned earlier, that these young men, a lot of them knew each other as a group, and that potentially there could have been that influence factor to changing the minds of their friends to also join them on this mission? How much of that family aspect do you think could have influenced the individuals that are their actual children and then the friends of these children to go to the Agadan and join this fight?
At least several of them, there appears to be some connection with their family being supportive. But then you have other cases where the family had no idea basically what had – they just knew that their son left one day and – they got a letter later saying he was in Ethiopia. So it definitely seems like the environment was there for them when they were children in some cases, but not so much in other cases. At least two of the guys also, they had become – one of the guys, he had – appears to have been quite religious, and he had become friends with another guy, and they both ended up going when they were students at Seljuk University in Konya.
And the four individuals that you highlight, not all of them knew each other, or did they all have some sort of connection, whether it was through school or personal connections, friends, family?
That I don't know. There's not the level of detail for all of the individuals that there is for some, but the individuals who have quite a bit of detail about them, there definitely appears to be some connection between them. And since there's reports that it was a relatively big group that went together, of at least, I mean, big in the sense of 10 guys all going at the same time, that it was likely that there was connections, prior connections between them. And six of them had gone to Bosnia, at least six of them had gone to Bosnia previously and had returned to Turkey afterwards.
Very interesting. So looking at this, you have these young men that have these aspirations. They make the ultimate choice to go there. But you alluded to it a bit at the starting of the talk of the Bosnia connection, which I'd really like to talk about a little bit more. And do you think the Bosnian connection was what really recruited these young individuals ultimately? Because, of course, nowadays we see a lot more recruitment happening via social media, internet access, and so forth, not just a community element. How is the recruitment happening back in 1996 as compared to today?
I think, I mean, in the mid-90s, I don't want to speak to this too much because I don't have that many details, but I think it was much more of a personal type situation, people talking to each other. It was a lot less, I guess it was a lot less stigmatized than it is now. I mean, there was no ISIS. I mean, there was really not, in 1996, Al-Qaeda was just a brand new thing, and it hadn't, 9/11 hadn't occurred or anything like that. I mean, going and fighting these conflicts had different connotations than going to fight in Afghanistan in the 2000s, and definitely in going and fighting in Syria now. And how people would view them both at home and abroad.
And how were these young individuals viewed back home in Turkey?
I mean, at least among their kind of family and friends, And from the information that's available, it seems like they were relatively, they're honored for this, their activities. And one interesting aspect is the individual Attila Sultan, who I had mentioned before, who had potentially been this kind of linchpin figure in getting all these other guys to the Ogaden. He actually had gone to the Ogaden and then returned to Turkey for some time, where he was going around the country and actually giving or appearing on television and radio programs, talking about the conflict, talking about the need for support for the conflict and the, you know, the injustice of it and the violence committed by Ethiopian troops. He ended up going back. He had been very close friends with one of the fighters I had mentioned previously, Ismail Öztürk, and he found out that Ismail Öztürk had been killed in a battle, and ultimately that spurred him to return to the Ogaden. But I mean, from the available information, at least in some quarters, they were honored. As you can see in the article, there's the story of four of the fighters killed actually became a cover story for a Islamist political newspaper or magazine from the mid-1990s. So it was definitely around if you were looking for it.
And I'd like to look a little bit more at the Bosnian connection. And you mentioned that Sultan was in Bosnia and met with individuals that mentioned this other jihad that was available in the Ogaden. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering if you could look at that a little bit in more detail, because it's actually a very interesting connection. And it really shows that once one jihad, so to speak, is over, that some individuals are looking for a second one to continue on and continue, I guess you could call it almost a legacy for them.
Yeah, I mean, Sultan, he had actually, I mean, he had been working in Istanbul, but actually he became, I mean, from the available information, he became more religious and actually moved to Germany with the ultimate goal of wanting to get to Bosnia to fight. So he had, at least for him, he had long had aspirations to be involved in these conflicts. Once that conflict was over, and I think that a lot of these guys were disappointed that they got there and there was nothing to do. And also with the Dayton Accords, they basically, it was illegal for them to be there anymore and they had to leave. They were kind of disappointed that they were not able to get involved in actual fighting and combat.
So fast forwarding to the Ogaden, you have these young men from Turkey that traveled there. Do you have sources on how they got there in the sense of, like with today with Syria, we see a lot of people going to Turkey and crossing the border and so forth. How was their trip from Turkey all the way to the Ogaden? How was that set up? How did they get there? How did they get the funds to do this?
Actually, that is the big gap in our research. There was not very much information at all about them actually, how they actually got there. It was more, they left from Turkey and they went to the Ogaden. I personally did not see any specific information about how they got there.
Yeah, I'll say it's difficult to tell from these Turkish fighters, but looking through some of the other Al-Qaeda documents that were declassified, a lot of them came through neighboring regions, and in particular Kenya, were able to get to Nairobi and then able to get to the border and in some cases even chartered a plane or a boat and wound up facilitating their way into Somalia through those means.
That's very interesting. So once they arrive in the Ogaden, what are the experiences of these young men? I assume they're going there with no prior military or military skills. Are they trained? Are they just thrown into the fight? How does this work? What is their experience?
It's possible that some of them had at least some military experience because in Turkey, there's everyone's serving the military. Some of them I know didn't, they were too young for that, or they were in college and it would come after they graduated from college. So it's possible that a few of them had some military experience, but there was definitely problems for some of them. They actually wrote home complaining that they received no combat training whatsoever, and they were not having a great time.
Yeah, I mean, I think at this time, you know, Somalia is a very harsh environment, and it's something we mentioned that some of the foreign fighters sort of maybe didn't meet their expectations, or they were a little disappointed. And you see this also in some of the literature on from the Al-Qaeda memos. I mean, it's a very difficult environment to begin with, very dry, very arid, food insecurity is a persistent issue. At the same time, within Somalia itself, there's the Somali clan system is notoriously difficult to navigate, especially for outsiders. There's other issues in terms of logistics, in terms of getting supplies to the region and to the camps. And remember, there's no real central government at this time, so there's a lot of competing warlords and militias and smaller power bases. And so that can also be a very bit of an anarchic time and something very difficult to navigate.
And did you see these young individuals almost sticking together in groups once they arrived there and were involved in the fight? Were they dispersed? I mean, this is a very hostile environment. What was that like? Did they stay together? Were they transferred to different units? How does this work?
It seems like they stayed together mainly because their reported deaths happened in two clusters. One was in an attack in August 96, and the second one was in an attack in December 1996. The battle in December 1996 was much deadlier, with 10 of the fighters reportedly being killed in it. So it was likely that they were together if that number had been killed. And actually, in the announcements of their deaths, there was also reports of other foreigners being killed. A Frenchman, an Algerian, a Saudi, a Gambian, and three Egyptians were killed with the first four Turks who were killed in August of 1996.
Do you know by any chance, do you have the data, did the foreign fighters, not just the Turkish individuals, but the individuals from the other regions and countries that you mentioned, were they put together in units? I mean, in Syria, you're starting to see almost what I'd call foreign fighter units, where they're sticking people that are all from France in one unit, Belgium in one unit. Was that something that was happening in the Ogaden back in 1996? Is there no data on that?
That I can't speak to. I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah, that's something, though, that you've seen also within Somalia in the current context, at least a few years ago when there was a more heightened amount of foreign fighters in the region. You saw some particular units organized like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing that you mentioned in your article is this concept of Turkish citizens fighting alongside, for instance, today, the Islamic State, and how this idea is very almost abnormal, an abnormal occurrence because of the Turkish state being very secular and, it's different compared to other countries. And I was wondering if we could kind of look at this concept a bit in the present situation in Syria as well as in the past with Ogaden.
Sure. I think the Ogaden is more similar to the conflict in Syria in about 2012, 2013. If you looked at the Turkish fighters who were killed during that period, they were far more similar to this. They were guys who had previous connections to other conflicts, who had relatives who had previous connections to these conflicts, and they were guys who were more ideologically kind of attuned, and even a little bit older guys, and they're more in their 20s. While I mean, sometimes you're seeing now, you know, just teenagers, guys who are 15, 16 years old from Ankara and different places going to Syria. I think that the Islamic State presents itself now, it's more of a broad-based social movement, ideological type thing, rather than the early days of Syria where people were going to fight, and they were going to fight Bashar al-Assad, not for, you know, to create an Islamic State, per se.
to look at to sort of bring this talk to a conclusion, the idea of what can we learn from this past experience in the Ogaden and transferring it to the present day. So we have these young individuals back in 1996, and then we have young individuals today in Syria and Iraq going to this completely different fight, but also very relevant as well. So what do we learn from the past that we can transfer here to the future?
I think the biggest thing that struck us while we were working on this is, you know, we've done a lot of reading about foreign fighters and looked at a lot of the literature on it, and this case just fit exactly into all of the more theoretical stuff on this topic. I mean, I think as then and now, when you just have young dudes who want to get involved in something and they feel like there's not an outlet for them and there's injustice, you know, young dudes are going to make rash decisions. Honestly, I don't know how, like, if it's that much more complicated.
And Mahmoud, I was wondering if you have any thoughts on this topic as well.
I think it's a really interesting sort of historical example, because a lot of these similar dynamics within the Horn of Africa region are going on today. There's still resistance within the Ogaden region. And really, while AI was sort of decimated during these attacks where these Turkish fighters wound up dying and the movement more or less kind of withered, a lot of the leaders who were part of that movement and had experience there have wound up going on to form some of the more prominent Islamist movements today, and in particular played roles within the Islamic Courts Union and Al-Shabaab, which is the biggest security threat within Somalia today. So it's interesting to see those parallels from there in the role that, while foreign fighters played within the Ogaden, also played an interesting role within Somalia a few years ago. So there's a lot of historical parallels, and even though this is 20 years ago, it's sort of a microcosm of things that are happening today and that really haven't been resolved within the region.
I think as long as these conflicts exist, there's going to be at least some group of young men who will want to become involved in them.
Very true. Yeah.
So we always like to give our guests a moment to either touch on something that we might not have touched on in the talk, or if there's a final word you'd like to provide the listeners with. So I'll give both of you a moment to maybe discuss something.
Actually, I think something that's not in the article but just came to mind was, if, for example, I ended the article with talking about Ismail Özturk and his twin brother, Osman Özturk, who followed his brother's footsteps and ended up being killed in Kashmir. In Syria, we've actually seen the very same case. There was two brothers. There was Azad Akinci and Mehmet Akinci. Azad Akinci was actually one of the primary planners of the 2003 HSBC bank bombings in Istanbul. And he eventually went to Iraq and actually was a suicide bomber in Iraq against U.S. forces. Well, his younger brother, Mehmet Akinci, when the conflict in Syria started, he was actually reported killed in 2012 in one of the first Turkish foreign fighters reported killed. There's, I think, with like the Ogaden, and now you're going to see the same sort of patterns of relationships once you start digging into cases. Especially with all the talk about social media and whatnot, I think at least in Turkey, when you actually dig into the backgrounds of people, you're going to see much more personal connections rather than social media or the online environment being the most important driving factor.
I would just add, it's just interesting to look at the narrative that was playing out there, and you had within the Ogaden sort of this emphasis on this Christian Ethiopian empire occupying Muslim land, in this case, Somali Muslim land. And that's something that that same sort of narrative has been played out time and time again in a lot of conflicts around that wind up drawing in this sort of foreign fighter element. And you have to look at, while AIAI basically failed in their mission and while all these Turkish foreign fighters were killed, they do wind up inspiring a lot of others through their actions. And so while maybe at the time Ethiopia and other elements within the region thought they had kind of eliminated this Islamist threat and whatnot, we can see clearly from events that have transpired since then that really hasn't been the case.
I'm sure as history continues, we're going to be seeing this repeated in different aspects, but it's sort of like history just keeps on repeating itself in different theaters.
Yeah. Yep. Maybe that's the conclusion.
Exactly. There you go. Well, thank you so much for both being on the show. It's been really interesting talking about this topic, and the article itself has some great research in it. So I hope our guests will read it. And as I said earlier in the talk, we will post a link to the piece. But thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you for having us.